The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Marwan Barghouti, he's serving five life sentences in an Israeli prison for his terrorist atrocities in the early 2000s. He murdered a Greek monk in 2001, and then less than a year later, he murdered three more Jews at a restaurant in Tel Aviv. All total, he's been directly responsible for five murders. And according to a number of Israeli sources, he's indirectly responsible for many dozens more, perhaps even into the hundreds. According to an Israeli court back in 2002, Barghouti led, operated, assisted, incited, and participated in acts of terror carried out by field commanders and terror activists, who were subordinate to them, and thus willfully caused the deaths of hundreds of Israelis. So he's one of the most notorious terrorists currently sitting in an Israeli prison, and he's a contributing writer to the New York Times. On Monday, that was a Jewish holiday, the New York Times published a 1,200-word op-ed piece by Marwan Barghouti. And in this article, its date is April 16th. It appeared in the April 17th print version of the New York Times. And as I say, Monday, the same day that this appeared in print, it was a Jewish holiday, and there were quite a few Jewish officials that didn't even get around to commenting on this piece or expressing their outrage until a good while after it had been in print. In any event, Barghouti explains in the piece why he's going on a hunger strike as he sits there in an Israeli prison. And at the end of the piece, this is all they've since amended it some, and I'll get to that in a minute. But at the end of the piece, the Times identifies Barghouti as a Palestinian leader and parliamentarian. That's it. That's the tagline. That's all that was there. His byline, 1,200 words. Most op-ed pieces are about 600 to 700 words. Barghouti gets 1,200 words, and that's all the New York Times has to say at the end. Michael Oren, he's the famous Israeli historian, the former ambassador to the United States. He's currently a member of the Kulanu Party in the Knesset. And he was saying in an interview the other day that this would have been like the New York Times printing an op-ed by Dylann Roof, the young man who killed all of those church members in the South. Here's the New York Times publishing a terrorist manifesto. That's what it amounts to. And a long one at that, 1,200 words. Barghouti says some 1,000 Palestinian, this is his op-ed, some 1,000 Palestinian prisoners have decided to take part in this hunger strike, which begins today, the day we observe here as Prisoners' Day. He says later, decades of experience have proved that Israel's inhumane system of colonial and military occupation aims to break the spirit of prisoners and the nation to which they belong by inflicting suffering on their bodies, separating them from their families and communities, using humiliating measures to compel subjugation. In spite of such treatment, it says, we will not surrender to it. This is what Marwan Barghouti said in the New York Times. On Monday, Israel, he says, an occupying power, has violated international law in multiple ways for nearly 70 years and yet has been granted impunity for its actions. It has committed grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions against the Palestinian people. The prisoners, including men, women, and children, are no exception. All these Palestinians are suffering at the hands of Israel, men, women, and children, and nothing was said of the men, women, and children that this man is responsible for murdering. Here the New York Times just prints it. No problem. In fact, the New York Times loves this kind of content. Anything to delegitimize Israel. Anything. Even if it's from a known terrorist. Even if it's coming from a mass murderer. The Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. This is the outfit in Jerusalem that used to be headed up by Dory Gold. Someone that we've met on a few occasions over the years. But they put out this video in response to Barghouti's fast, his hunger strike. And this is what they had to say this week, clip one.
Marwan Barghouti is a murderer and the leader of a terror organization. He was directly responsible for the deaths of five people in terror attacks, in four terror attacks, including four Israelis and one Greek monk. And he was the person who was closest to Yasser Arafat, the chairman of the Palestinian Authority at the time. And on his behalf, he actually was running the operation on the field. Whenever somebody was questioning the policy, whether the terror attacks should continue or not, it was Marwan Barghouti who was telling everybody to go on with the terror attacks. His direct involvement in that was first when he ordered some of the terror groups to carry out attacks on his behalf. And many, many, many others were killed by groups that were directed and commanded by him. And on top of that, Marwan Barghouti receives a generous salary from the Palestinian Authority that looks upon the prisoners as the heroes and the fighting sector of the Palestinian society. All his attempt to carry out a hunger strike on behalf of the Palestinian prisoners is a political move. Even today, from during his time in prison, he was involved in all kinds of initiatives that call for the continuation of the terror activities against Israelis. This is the real Marwan Barghouti.
That's right, the real Marwan Barghouti. He was right at the front lines of the Second Intifada. A right-hand man of Yasser Arafat heading up a terror organization. And, of course, now with Mahmoud Abbas's health in decline, he wants out so that he can succeed Abbas. And the Western media is helpfully whitewashing away all the blood on his hands. As I said earlier, anything to delegitimize Israel, anything to build up the Palestinian people. And to put terrorists in charge. Going back to his manifesto, this is what the New York Times printed, and without even fact-checking it. In that interview I mentioned, Michael Oren, he was talking about, or comparing this to printing an op-ed by Dylann Roof. He went on and said in that same exchange that anytime he submitted an op-ed to the New York Times over the years, I mean, they check every single word. If it's coming from him, if it's coming from a distinguished historian and former ambassador to the United States, they check every dot, every point of punctuation, every letter, every word. And yet here is this terrorist in prison, this mass murderer, and he turns over 1,200 words, not one bit of it's fact-checked. It's just, well, here's half the editorial page. Help yourself. Say what you want. A total whitewash. Barghouti said, Israel has tried to brand us all as terrorists to legitimize its violations. Israel's the demon here. Including mass arbitrary arrests, torture, punitive measures, and severe restrictions as part of Israel's effort to undermine the Palestinian struggle for freedom. An Israeli court sentenced me to 5 life sentences. It says Israel is not the first occupying or colonial power to resort to such, I mean, he knows exactly how to word it, to get the mainstream media, all of them on his side. Well, Israel's just a colonial power. It says every national liberation movement in history can recall similar practices. This is why so many people who have fought against oppression, colonialism, and apartheid stand with us. Yes, a lot of people stand with him even. With him. He's a convicted murderer. Now you can understand why there was quite an outcry coming from Israel after this op-ed appeared in the newspaper on Monday, the paper of record of all things. And then this is what the New York Times added later. Editor's note appended. All that they had said previous to this was that, hey, he's a Palestinian leader and parliamentarian. He's a distinguished leader, this Barghouti. Well, then they, after the outrage, they added this. It says, this article, this is the New York Times, this article explained the writer's prison sentence, but neglected to provide sufficient context by stating the offenses of which he was convicted. It says they were 5 counts of murder and membership in a terrorist organization. Mr. Barghouti declined to offer a defense at his trial and refused to recognize the Israeli court's jurisdiction and legitimacy. So it talks about the convictions, the 5 murders, but then also points out that Barghouti sees the Israeli court as illegitimate. Not 1 ounce of regret in this appended note that's now there on this article, the online version, that is. Not 1 apology, nothing like that. Here's a man, as I say, who has the blood of dozens of people on his hands, and yet you're not going to get the paper of record to apologize for just flowing in 1,200 words, assuming it was written by Barghouti or someone who represented him. You're not going to get the paper of record to even fact check it. It just goes right in because it fits right in with its agenda. And I think it's interesting, just as a point of contrast, you saw, no doubt, at least if you're in America, yesterday that Bill O'Reilly was forced out at Fox News for sexual harassment. And the New York Times is largely responsible for bringing him down. I mean, they see Fox News as a huge target. And again, I don't know anything about the actual behavior of Bill O'Reilly, but he hasn't been convicted of murder. He's not a mass murderer. It says here in the New York Times piece this morning, Bill O'Reilly's reign as the top-rated host in cable news came to an abrupt and embarrassing end on Wednesday as Fox News forced him out after the disclosure of a series of sexual harassment allegations against him and an internal investigation that turned up even more. It says Mr. O'Reilly and his employers came under intense pressure after an article by the New York Times on April 1st. What is today? April the 20th. 3 weeks ago, the New York Times comes out with this huge expose on Bill O'Reilly and Fox News. And within 3 weeks, 3 weeks' time, this man who's been on nightly news, or I guess it's an opinion show for Fox, for 20 years, his career is destroyed, at least his career with Fox News. He'll probably find somewhere else, I suppose, to continue on with what he does. But look at the resources. As Michael Oren pointed out, I mean, if he submits an article to the New York Times, you can be sure they're going to comb through everything printed on that page to fact check it. They've got to fact check it when it's coming from an enemy. You can be sure that they devoted a lot of resources to bring down Bill O'Reilly. And they worked to do the same thing, or at least their friends in the major media worked to do the same thing, of course, with Donald Trump. When it's an enemy, I mean, you wonder how many people are guilty of this sort of behavior that they accuse Bill O'Reilly all across media circles. I mean, but see, Bill O'Reilly, he's a big target. It says Mr. O'Reilly and his employ. Well, I read that earlier. It says here a little bit later, the agreements totaled about $13 million. So they uncovered the fact that he had paid off, I guess, five women who came forward with these claims just to move on and not have it go to court. It says here later, since then, more than 50, well, they're losing all kinds of advertisements or sponsors for the program. And then it says here, finally, that left Mr. O'Reilly's fate in the hands of the Murdoch family, which controls 21st Century Fox. In the end, according to two people familiar with the decision, Rupert Murdoch and his sons, James and Lachlan, made their call after reviewing the results of an internal investigation that found that multiple women had reported inappropriate behavior by Mr. O'Reilly. And so, supposing they made the right decision. I mean, that's a Fox News issue, I suppose. But just the approach that the New York Times has taken just this week, I mean, proudly proclaiming that it had a hand in bringing him down. I mean, they came under intense pressure after we revealed on April the 1st. We've uncovered this. He needs to go. The protesting needs to begin now. The advertisers, they have got to pull out. And meanwhile, in the very same week, or at least right around the same time, here you have this convicted murderer, this convicted mass murderer with the blood of perhaps hundreds of Israelis on his hands. And he's allowed to freely print his terrorist manifesto in the pages of the New York Times, the paper of record, in order to delegitimize Israel. It's astounding, really. We go through that verse so often when we talk about, and it's no wonder so many people are just fed up with the fake news that's everywhere. Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." One last little tidbit, Michael Oren, in this interview I heard this morning from a couple of days ago, he was talking about another egregious error. I think it was in an op-ed by Mahmoud Abbas years ago, and several things were not factual in that piece. He called up the editor of the opinion page and said, "This is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, and this is wrong." And the editor basically said, "Well, that's your opinion." And he said, "Well, hang on a second. There's facts. I mean, these are provable facts. There's no debating." "Well, that's your opinion. Everything's relative. Truth is relative in the world of the media today." Jesus said, as I said, Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." You have to know it. You have to know what's right and what's wrong. And without God, I mean, you have really no foundation to stand on. That's why everything keeps moving. The goalposts keep moving. We have to go to God. It's not that all knowledge is in the Bible, but it's the foundation. We have to go to God and to His Word to find truth. To find God's truth. That's what you get on this program. Not that we're incapable of making mistakes. We certainly do make mistakes, and at the trumpet too. But all of these articles, these programs, the Key of David, everything that's produced by God's work, it's based on the sure word of God's truth. In the case of news commentary, the sure word of Bible prophecy, as Peter said. It has to be based on that, or else there's no real foundation. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email the program this week. You can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Just to close the loop on the subject we discussed there in the first segment, just in flipping through during the break here, page 88 of the Key of David booklet, I wanted to refer to this with what I want to talk about next, but this came to mind as I was talking about that opinion piece by Marwan Barghouti from Monday. And my father says in the Key of David booklet, page 88, "So why is there so much hatred of Jews? Look at the Middle East today. The Jews of the tiny nation of Israel are despised by their neighbors. Many Arabs want to see the Jewish nation destroyed, including Marwan Barghouti, we could add. They want to see the Jewish nation destroyed. In our time, Jews have been hated in Russia. There's still anti-Semitism in the United States and other countries. And can we forget what Hitler and his Nazi scourge did to the Jews? Where is all of this hate coming from? A thinking person has to wonder. We know the Jews, like all humans, have helped to create some of their own problems, but we must see," he says, "that there's something deeper behind anti-Semitism. I mean, there's something behind this. There's a spirit behind this. You can't even explain it. It doesn't make sense to someone who knows the truth unless you know the spirit behind it. You know that there is a spirit behind it. There is." Well, that same chapter in John 8, it speaks about the father of lies. It speaks about the father of murder. "You are of your father, the devil." That's what Jesus said to those he was talking to in John 8. Well, I'll just leave that for you to study. But it's an interesting, really a fascinating chapter that I think that's the chapter 8 or 9 in the Key of David booklet, Satan's Great Wrath. Go back and study that middle chapter of the Key of David booklet. I was going through the earlier chapters of the booklet recently, talking about the importance of the United States and Britain in Prophecy, the most popular book Herbert Armstrong ever wrote. It went to, I think, more than 6 million addresses worldwide. 6 million of those books were distributed around the world from the 1930s on through to 1986, the year that Herbert Armstrong died. And in that same year, the successors, Mr. Armstrong's successors, they came out with an updated version of that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, and it was significantly watered down, the message. This message that had gone out to 6 million people Well, 6 million homes, probably more like 15 or 20 million people. They started to water it down, though, immediately. This popular book, the following year, this is 1987, they took that that book that was nearly 200 pages, and they cut it back to 53 pages. They cut out almost three-fourths of the material, deleting all of the last four chapters of the book. The rousing conclusion. The last four chapters, if you haven't read The United States and Britain in Prophecy, I mean, it tells you what's going to happen in the years right in front of us. They deleted all that from their smaller version of the book in 1987. And of course, and many of you know this history, it's discussed in Raising the Ruins. But by the middle of 1988, the book was gone. The United States and Britain in Prophecy, the most requested book the Worldwide Church of God ever produced. A book that, as my father has said before, it probably did more to build the Worldwide Church of God than any other book the church published. I mean, it's probably the greatest book that's been written in our time on prophecy. And yet the Worldwide Church of God, they set it aside. They buried it, and they didn't want anyone else to get it. We learned that in the lawsuit many years later, from 1997 through to 2003. Look over at Revelation 3. We'll just read a few verses here. Because when that happened, when that church buried the truth in the United States and Britain in prophecy, I mean, they lost their spiritual vision. The Bible says where there's no vision, the people perish. And look at what's happened to that church. Look at what's happened to those people, so many of God's people. They've just gone to sleep. Revelation 3, verse 17 says about them, "Because you say, I'm rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing, and know not that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked." I mean, you think you're rich and increased with goods. You think you don't need anything. But you don't realize that you're blind. You don't realize that you've lost your prophetic vision. That's what's happened to most of God's people in these latter days. They're spiritually blind. Why would so many in the Worldwide Church of God, so soon after Herbert Armstrong's death, why would so many want to do away with this book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy? The book that reveals the truth about David's throne. I mean, that book really, really, it's the core teaching of the Key of David vision, which is discussed also in chapter 3 here in the Philadelphia section. We'll look at that in just a bit, but turn over to Luke 1. These are familiar scriptures to many of you. Luke chapter 1 and verse 31. And let's see what the New Testament says about Jesus Christ. The fact that he was born to be king, Luke 1 and verse 31 says, "And behold, you shall conceive in your womb and bring forth a son and shall call his name Jesus." So Mary gave birth to a son named Jesus. And of course, this was no ordinary son. I mean, this was the Son of the Highest, as it says in verse 32. It says, "He shall be great and shall be called the Son of the Highest. And the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his father David." That's future tense. God in heaven, God the Father, shall give unto this son, Jesus Christ, the throne of his father David. Jesus, of course, coming from that physical line, David's line. But more important than that is the fact that he was born to be king. He was born to rule from the throne of David. It says in verse 33, "And he shall reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. Once Jesus takes control of that throne, he's going to rule over the house of Israel and the world forever. That's obviously not happened yet, but it's coming. It's coming soon. It's coming at the return of Jesus Christ. My father wrote, going back to that Key of David booklet, it's actually a little book, 150 pages or so. It says, when we understand the depth and the magnitude of these three verses in Luke, Luke 1, verses 31 through 33, when we understand the depth and the magnitude of these three verses, it's truly mind-boggling what God plans to do with mankind. David's life is an inspiring example of what God plans to do with all humanity. He says, David, a man, represents all people who have ever lived. David, a man. See, God wants to bring us right into this Key of David vision, this family vision, this royal family throne. Going back to Revelation 3, let's just back up into that Philadelphia section. I read that one verse, what God says there about the Laodicean era, the seventh and final era of God's church, that they would be blind, spiritually blind and naked. Here in Revelation 3, verse 7, it says here, and the angel of the church in Philadelphia, right? These things says he that is holy, he that is true, he that has the key of David, he that opens and no man shuts, and shuts and no man opens. So this is how Jesus Christ introduces the Philadelphia era of God's church. He says they have the key of David. And then he relates how that he opens a door for the work because of that. I know your works, verse 8. Behold, I've set before you an open door, and no man can shut it, for you have a little strength, and have kept my word, and have not denied my name. Now just look at the difference in the work, God's work, in Herbert Armstrong's time and in the Takaches that followed him. Look at what's happened to the work since Herbert Armstrong died. And yet when he was alive, when Mystery of the Ages was going out to the largest audience possible, and the United States and Britain in Prophecy and the Incredible Human Potential and the Missing Dimension in Sex, and all of these wonderful works, when they were going out, I mean, the work really was growing and expanding. God kept opening doors. That's what it says there in verse 8. God set before Mr. Armstrong an open door. God miraculously opened doors for his work during the Philadelphia era. And of course, when Christ would open the door, Mr. Armstrong would walk right on through. But the door, or the open door, is synonymous with this message going out. And so much of that message, so much of that truth, revolves around the content discussed in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. As I say, to paraphrase my dad, it's probably the greatest book ever written on prophecy. When you think about the Key of David vision and all the content there from U.S. and Britain, identifying modern-day Israel, discussing that covenant God made with David, the throne of David, and how that, as we just read from Luke 1, how that Jesus Christ is to rule the world from David's throne. This is what the Key of David vision is all about. As my father writes in the booklet, this is the one vision that identifies God's end-time Philadelphia church. This is critical understanding, he says. Christ introduces the Philadelphia era by saying he has the key of David. Then he relates how he opens the door for God's work Today, Christ opens the door only for the very elect who have the key of David vision. So he gives you that key of David vision. Then he opens the door for that message to go out. And then God's people, they proclaim it. We just read through verse 8 where it says they don't deny God's name or his authority, his government. They're obedient to God. Their heart is in God's work. And they remain steadfast all the way through to the end. Verse 11 here in Revelation 3, it says, "Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which you have, that no man take your crown." So God's offering positions of rule to the first fruits as well, to the bride of Jesus Christ as well. It says, "Him that overcomes will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out. And I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name." We have to overcome, though, or conquer. That's really a better word for the Greek text there. Hold fast to this crown. Hold fast to this position of authority. Overcome and conquer our adversary, the devil. And then verse 13, it says, "He that has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. Hear what the Spirit is saying to all seven eras of the church. Heed these warnings. What a message. What a work. The open doors. The impact that it had on the entire world. When we come back, I'll just back up a little bit again to those crucial verses there at the beginning of the Philadelphia section there in Revelation 3, and then talk further about these open doors, these doors that God opens for his work. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
I'm speaking to you from our television studios in Pasadena, where I speak to the world as a voice crying out in the wilderness of modern religious confusion.
Herbert W. Armstrong was the world's leading televangelist and one of the most prominent religious leaders of the 20th century. Watched, read, and followed by millions worldwide. But his legacy of Bible-based humanitarianism came under attack after he died. The cabal of leaders who took control of the church he founded, after pledging to follow in his footsteps, methodically destroyed all he had built. Those who would stop them were silenced or excommunicated. This shocking story of betrayal and deception is told in Raising the Ruins. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
Now he said, "This gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed or preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come."
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
So those first two verses opening the Philadelphia section there in Revelation 3, verse 7 again, talks about the key of David, if you have the key of David, or he that has the key of David, he that opens and no man shuts, and shuts and no man opens. I mean, that's the kind of authority and power there is behind the work of God. God opens doors, and when God opens it, no man can shut it. Mr. Armstrong, he used to get so excited when he'd talk about doors swinging open for the work. It didn't matter if it was a huge door or a small one or anything in between. If God opened it, that got him excited. The thing is, when God does the, well, when he opens the door, we've got to walk on through. We've got to walk through in faith. We'll see that more clearly even from a verse over in Acts, but just to repeat, verse 8, I know your works. Behold, I've set before you an open door, and no man can shut it. For you have a little strength and have kept my word and have not denied my name. I mean, here is a church or a work that's really very little strength. And yet if we concentrate on getting the message out and going right on through the door, look at the work that is done. I've read this quote before from Mr. Armstrong's autobiography, where when he learned early on in his ministry that he couldn't rely on men, but that he had to solely rely on God for direction, for support and encouragement, obviously for the truth. But once he came to realize that, or once he learned that lesson, he says in the autobiography that Jesus Christ began opening doors right away. He said small at first, but then bigger and bigger doors as the work unfolded, as the time went on. That's the great lesson there is in this for us, not just as a work or a church, but individually as well. That if we rely solely on God, God will take care of us. I touched on this just at the end of the program yesterday. That verse in Acts, let's just look at this, Acts 14. As you turn over there, if you want to read along with me, here again, just a little snippet from the Key of David booklet. My father says, an open door is always synonymous with the preaching of a message. See, there's a reason why God opens doors. It's to get a message out. It's to get the truth out. It's to disseminate the truth. My father's also said before that there's only one work distributing that message. Walking through that door, he said, what an honor it is that we can be where the open door is. Acts 14, here in verse 27, it says, and when they were come and had gathered the church together, they rehearsed all that God had done with them and how he had opened the door of faith, it says, unto the Gentiles. God opened the door of faith to the Apostle Paul and to others that were serving him in the first century. Here it says it's a door of faith. It's a door of faith because we know by faith that Jesus Christ is the head of the church, that he's the one opening the door, and that we have to walk on through in faith. We have to follow our husband. We have to follow our head. Notice another example. This is from 1 Corinthians 16, Paul's book to the brethren at Corinth, or the letter that he wrote to the brethren at Corinth. 1 Corinthians 16, and notice verse 5. It says, now I will come unto you when I shall pass through Macedonia, for I do pass through Macedonia, Paul says, and it may be that I will abide, yes, and winter with you, that you may bring me on my journey wherever I go. For I will not see you now by the way, but I trust to tarry a while with you if the Lord permits. I mean, if this was God's will, I mean, I hope to pass by and to spend some time with you, perhaps the entire winter. We'll see. Verse 8 says, but I will tarry at Ephesus until Pentecost, for a great door and effectual is opened unto me, and there are many adversaries. I mean, God was opening huge doors for the work. And so Paul here says, I'll tarry at Ephesus until Pentecost. I mean, these were the holy days that he was observing. But the door, the opportunity to disseminate Christ's gospel message, that's what got Paul really excited. Going back to the Key of David booklet, My father says, that's why the world, the whole world, can see the Philadelphia work. The open door. The message is sent around the globe. The open door, or work, is what identifies God's true church to the earth's inhabitants. That's what identifies God's true church. You can see the work of God. You can see the church of God in the work that it's doing, in the message it's proclaiming. The example of those Laodiceans that very quickly rejected the United States and Britain in prophecy, well, look at what happened to their work. They rejected the Key of David vision, and then they didn't have any open doors to deliver the message. They didn't want to. They didn't want to disseminate that message. And so God shut the doors. That's the Laodicean, the seventh era. Let's just go back to Revelation 3 and look at the fifth era. This is the Sardis era. And in the Key of David booklet, my father, in the first chapter, some excellent material there about Mr. Armstrong early on in his ministry coming into contact with brethren from the Sardis era. Notice what God says about that era of the church. This is Revelation 3. And verse 1, it says, and unto the angel of the church in Sardis write, these things says he that has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars, I know your works, and you have a name that you live and are dead. So this particular church era was dead. I've talked before when we went through a church history series for some videos we produced 2 or 3 years ago, about all of the advantages that this church era had. The people of God had a relative amount of freedom that they weren't used to during the Middle Ages. And then, of course, the emergence of the printing press and just the access to Bibles. The King James translation in 1611. The fact that so many of God's people had the freedom to do the work. The Catholic Church didn't have the stranglehold on the church. Not in the UK, anyway. But as I've noted before, what a missed opportunity. Even with these advantages, God says about the Sardis era of his church, you have a name that you live, and yet you're dead. You're dead. The brethren of God in this particular era did not capitalize on all of the opportunities, on all of the possibilities that God gave to them. They didn't fight for the truth. They lacked the faith to walk through open doors. They weren't doing a work. They had some bits and pieces of the truth. Mr. Armstrong writes about this in his autobiography, but they weren't doing a work. And notice what God says to them. Verse 2 of Revelation 3, it says, be watchful and strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die, for I have not found your works perfect before God. God says to them, look, you've made some mistakes here. And part of the problem is you're not watching. You don't have spiritual vision. I mean, these were God's people, but they didn't watch world events. They weren't warning the world of what's to come before the return of Jesus Christ. You can study into the Greek for be watchful there, the first two words of the verse. It means to wake up. It means to strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die. You've got to breathe life into them. Be watchful. Wake up, it says, verse 3. It continues, remember, therefore, how you have received and heard, and hold fast and repent, God says. If, therefore, you shall not watch, I will come on you as a thief, and you shall not know what hour I will come upon you. In other words, if they didn't wake up and strengthen those things that were about to die, well, they would just, as a church or as an era of the church, they would just die. They'd be caught unawares by the return of Jesus Christ. Now, what's fascinating in that first chapter of the Key of David booklet, and my father brings this out, it's how God sent Herbert Armstrong to those Sardis brethren in order to wake them up. God sent his servant to those scattered brethren to remind them why we're called into the church in the first place. And this is how the book begins, the Key of David booklet, where Mr. Armstrong was searching for the true church. He was searching for the work. But something, as my father brings out, something really disturbed him in his search. He says, the church, this is my father writing about that history, the church he affiliated himself with had more of God's truth than any other, but the work it was doing was insignificant. They weren't doing a work. They were just kind of holding on to some bits and pieces of the truth. And then Mr. Armstrong associated with them early on and thought, well, they've got more of the truth than some of these other organizations, but if this is the work of God, where is the life? Where is the life? Where is the energy? Where is the work that's being done? Well, he came into contact with an organization that the Bible describes as dead. Revelation 3 and verse 1. Notice what my father went on to say. This is in the Key of David booklet, first chapter. The Sardis church had a good history at one time, but had forgotten it. Be watchful, God said. I'm going to send you the truth. I'll warn you and give you an opportunity to change. And God did that through Herbert Armstrong, but they didn't heed. And what does God say would happen if they failed to be watchful? My father says individuals die spiritually, so do churches, but God always warns us. Realize what was going on at this point in the church's history. The Sardis era had died, and yet God sent a man with special revelation to give the Sardis people an opportunity to revive, a chance to repent and turn things around. He always does that when we go off track. The Sardis leader even admitted that this was truth revealed by God. Well, just to backtrack and cover what I left out, Mr. Armstrong, he had approached the leadership in this church about a minor error in their teachings, that the leadership said, well, you're right, but we can't change it because the people wouldn't like it. Mr. Armstrong couldn't understand that, and then later he presented them with the manuscript that was to become the United States and Britain in prophecy. And here again, the leadership, the Sardis leadership, in the ministers in the church, they admitted to Mr. Armstrong that this is the truth. This indeed has been revealed by God. There surely is a special reason that God's given you this truth. That's what the Sardis ministers were saying to Mr. Armstrong. And yet, they rejected it. And yet, they rejected the knowledge, the truth, the knowledge about the Key of David vision contained in the United States and Britain in prophecy. My father says in the Key of David booklet that God was trying to save the Sardis era. How could a loving father not reach out and try to save his family when he sees them going astray? He says everything is at stake. God doesn't want to see any of his beloved children have their names blotted out of the book of life. It all shows just how loving and merciful and patient and persistent God is in trying to wake up his people. Be watchful. Be watchful. Strengthen the things which remain. Hold on to these precious truths. Don't let them go. Here they were going to sleep as an era of God's church, and God raised up Herbert Armstrong. Here comes Mr. Armstrong with the truth about the United States and Britain. The truth about the throne of David. The truth about the key of David vision. And well, that church was going to sleep, dying, in fact. And once Herbert Armstrong then finally broke free from that dead organization, God started opening doors right and left. Little ones at first, but then bigger doors. To the point where, by the end of his ministry in 1986, I mean, that message, like the United States and Britain in prophecy, 6 million books distributed. That message, that truth, had gone right around the world. Verse 4 says, "You have a few names, even in Sardis, which have not defiled their garments, and they shall walk with me in white, for they are worthy." Only a few, you see. Only a few were faithful to the end. And it says, finally, "He that overcomes, the same shall be clothed in white raiment." Same warning, the same message. We've got to hear the same spirit, the same head, who's Jesus Christ. We've got to overcome and conquer and really hold on to this key of David vision. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email the program this week. Send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you again tomorrow.